First Testament book of Job is unique. It's not a book about rules and laws. It's not a book about invasions and battles or captivity and punishment. It's not a book about future prophecies, nor is it a letter to a struggling church in Asia Minor. Job is a fictional story about a contest between God and his adversary, the Satan. Satan suggests that the righteous man Job is only righteous because he is greatly blessed and prosperous. But if God were to take away everything that he had, Job would no longer be a faithful servant of Yahweh. When Israel read this book, they were supposed to contemplate the following questions for themselves throughout the ages. Is Yahweh a good God? Is Yahweh omnipotent? Is he the most powerful being? Is Yahweh in control of the universe and our part in it, even when bad things happen? And are we justified in forsaking Yahweh and turning to other regional gods if he no longer appears to be favoring and blessing us? The book begins with this prologue. In the land of Uz, there was a man whose name was Job. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters, and he owned 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, which was a lot, 500 yoke of oxen, so 1,000 in total, and 500 donkeys, and he had a large number of servants, all the signs of success and wealth. And it concludes with, he was the greatest man among all the people of the East. How do we know this is a fictional story and not a depiction of real events? Well, let's read the next section in Job 1, verse 6. One day the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them. And the Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" As if God wouldn't know. Satan answered the Lord, "From roaming throughout the earth, going back and forth on it," sort of doing his rounds, cruising around, checking things out. And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There's no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil." And it doesn't say this, but clearly Satan would have replied, "Yeah, I've seen him in my travels, in my cruising. I've noticed him." "Does Job fear God for nothing?" Satan replied. "Is there no good reason why he's faithful to you? Have you not put a hedge around him, protecting him and his household and everything he has? You have blessed the work of his hands so that his flocks and his herds are spread throughout the land. But now stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and he will surely curse you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, "Very well then. Everything he has is in your power. Do what you want with it. But on the man himself, do not lay a finger." Now, we don't know who wrote the book of Job, but we do know one thing. Whoever wrote it was not up in heaven listening to this conversation. There was no one recording who said what to whom. This is a fictional scenario in order to teach a lesson. So the book of Job is primarily a book of guidance and counsel to people of Israel and Judah that God is greater than Satan, and no matter how difficult your life becomes, God is still worthy of praise and honor and worship, because if he can control the forces of nature and the universe, then he's perfectly capable of controlling your tiny, insignificant by comparison, slice of life. Job is secondarily a story about one man, his family, his possessions, and about his friends. And it's Job's friends that we will focus on today, because I think they get a raw deal. they are ultimately presented as an obstacle to Job's learning and growth and the progress through this fiery trial. Near the conclusion of the experience, God condemns these three weak, unhelpful, and seemingly faithless associates named Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. We can't even really call them friends, can we? In Job 42:7, the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, "I am angry with you and your two friends because you have not spoken the truth about me, as my servant Job has. So now take seven bulls and seven rams and go to my servant Job and sacrifice a burnt offering for yourselves in order to be forgiven, basically, for being so foolish, so weak, so unhelpful." The main criticism that the author is drawing our attention to here is that Job's friends underestimated the control that God has over our lives. So when good things happen, everyone agrees that we can attribute that to the blessings from God. But when bad things happen, they're also caused or allowed by God to teach or counsel us in some way. And bad things happen in our life should not be a justification for rejecting God. Job's friends were suggesting the opposite, that God was not good, because human suffering should be seen as punishment for sins, and Job was righteous. And clearly the evidence was there with all of the physical wealth and possessions that he had. Furthermore, if this was about undisclosed sins, or sins that Job wasn't aware of, then surely a good God should illuminate the cause of the suffering. Why was this happening? In order to allow him to respond to it, thus ending the pain. At one point, weary of their unhelpful rhetoric, Job told them, "You are miserable comforters, all of you." That's in Job 16, verse 2. "You're miserable comforters. You're no good. You're making things worse. This is not what a friend should be." But I want to take a different perspective on Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. The problem is, we have the benefit of hindsight. They did not have this. They lacked understanding of what was happening with this competition between Satan and God. None of the three friends could possibly have known that Job's circumstance was part of a divine challenge and not caused by sin. This was not an ordinary scenario. I want to zoom in on the things that the friends did right, because although the author's intention is to highlight the lesson that Job must learn, and thus we must learn, as far as friends go, I would hope that in such a severe trial, if I were going through something similar, I would have friends this good. But before we get there, let's pick up the story of Job's trial. So here's what happened. Job 1, 13 to 18. So God and Satan have had this discussion. God gives Satan permission to do whatever he wants to Job, except don't harm his person. Don't harm him physically. So one day when Job's sons and daughters were at a different location feasting at the older brother's house, a messenger arrived at Job's house with the news. "Your oxen were plowing, with the donkeys feeding beside them, and when the Sabaeans raided us, they stole all the animals and killed all the farmhands, and I am the only one who escaped to tell you about this." Oh no, tragedy. His livestock and the farmhands have all been stolen or killed. And while he was still speaking, this first messenger, a second messenger arrived with the news. "The fire of God has fallen from heaven and burnt up your sheep and all the shepherds, and I am the only one who escaped to tell you about it." Bad news upon bad news. And while that person, that messenger, was still speaking, a third messenger rushed in with the news, "Three bands of Chaldean raiders have stolen your camels and killed your servants, and I am the only one who escaped to tell you." And while he was still speaking, another messenger arrived with the news, "Your sons and daughters were feasting in their oldest brother's home. And suddenly a powerful wind swept in from the wilderness and hit the house on all sides. The house collapsed, and all your children are dead. And I am the only one who escaped to tell you." And Job 1:22 said, "In all this, Job did not sin by blaming God." That would have been the normal blame. "God has done this to punish me for something that I have done." Do you remember when David committed adultery with Bathsheba and they had a child together? And God said to David, "To punish you, your child is going to die because of your sin. You got to pay a penalty for sin." So Job would have normally you would expect that he would normally, what horror, what dread, your children are all dead, your whole family is dead. Doesn't mention his wife, but your everything you own, all of your property, all of your livestock, all of your servants, and all of your children are dead. What you have here right now in your house, Job, what you currently possess, that is all you have left. Be like someone having a house fire and they grab a few valuables as they flee, and you stand outside watching the house burn, and everything, all your memories, all your photographs, your artwork, your kids' drawings, everything they grew up with, their toys when they were children, your prized possessions, all of it is now gone, and what you're holding in your hand and your car is it. Sometime later, Satan goes back to heaven to challenge God further, because he hasn't won yet, because Job hasn't yet cursed God. The Lord asks Satan in Job 2, verse 3, "Have you noticed my servant Job? Have you noticed?" There's almost a bit of sarcasm there. Didn't work, did it, eh? Mate, it didn't work. I told you it wouldn't work. "Have you noticed my servant Job? He is the finest man in all the earth. He is blameless, a man of complete integrity. He fears God even after everything that's happened and stays away from evil. And he has maintained his integrity even though you urged me to harm him without cause." And Satan replied, "Oh yeah? I can do better than this. The only reason he still is faithful to you is because you haven't let me harm him. Skin for skin. A man will give up everything he has to save his life, but reach out and take away his health, and then he will surely curse you to his face, to your face." "All right," God says, "do with him as you please," the Lord said to Satan, "but spare his life." So anything right up to the point where he would die, the next step, the most extreme thing that could happen would be death. But everything up to that point, go ahead. And so Satan struck Job with terrible boils from head to toe. Now, have you ever had one boil? Have you ever had a blister? Anything that was just irritating and painful? Now, picture being completely covered. All of the surface of your skin is now in boils. It says Job took a piece of broken pottery to scrape the boils. They were agony as he sat among the ashes. And his wife said to him, "Are you still trying to maintain your integrity? Curse God and die. You don't need this." Remember, they're in a culture where there's lots of other gods to choose from. There's lots of gods that would be presumably not able to or willing to do what Yahweh is doing to Job. And Job just will not. He replied, "You talk like a foolish woman. Should we accept only good things from the hand of God and not anything bad?" So in all this, Job still did nothing wrong. And this is where the point where the three friends show up in Job 2:12. The friends, when they saw Job from a distance, scarcely recognized him. He'd probably lost a lot of weight, probably wouldn't have been interested in eating, covered in bleeding sores. When they saw him, they hardly recognized him, and wailing loudly, they tore their clothes and threw dust into the air to show their grief. And then they sat down on the ground with him for 7 days and nights. No one said a word to Job, for they saw that his suffering was too great for words. Wow. That, forget anything else that they may have said later, forget what the Bible tells us about how weak these people were, how misguided in their counsel and their advice. 7 days and seven nights they sat in the ashes next to Job, being there with him. That's compassion. That's dedication. When was the last time you just sat with someone suffering for a whole week in silence? Eliphaz encouraged Job, pointing out how righteous and faithful he had been, how he had been the one to encourage others to trust in God. In Job 4, verse 3, in the past, it's been you, Job, who have encouraged many people. You have strengthened those who are weak. Your words have supported those who were failing. You encouraged those with shaky knees. But now when trouble strikes, you lose heart. You're trying to encourage them. Think about what you would tell other people if you saw them like this, Job. Remember, this is after a week. This is now they're starting to talk to him. Because how long is this going to go on for? 7 days and nights and not a word? Just comforting him, just being there with him, being present with him. And finally they figure something's got to change here. So, Job, what would you tell other people? You are terrified when disaster touches you. Doesn't your reverence for God give you confidence? Doesn't your life of integrity give you hope? Like, this has got to end soon because you're a righteous man. So the friends are giving advice based upon the information that they had been taught about God, which is God will always come through for you. God will never leave you nor forsake you. Pain and suffering is a punishment for sin. So eventually this is going to clear up, Job. Don't give up hope. Eliphaz concludes his encouragement to Job with this in Job 22:4. Is it for piety that God rebukes you and brings charges against you? Like, are you too good? What's this all about? Is not your wickedness great? Are not your sins endless? He's saying there must be something that you don't know about. Let's try to find out what that is. Based upon what the old scriptures taught about God, then yes, suffering is punishment. And the way to end it is to repent, to root out the problem in your life, examine yourself, and express contrition, bring a sacrifice, and then the trial comes to an end. That's the formula. This is not that formula. This is not that arrangement. This is different. But Eliphaz and the friends could not have known that. So they're giving advice based on what the scriptures taught them about God. In Job 22:21, they say, submit to God and be at peace with him. In this way, prosperity will come back to you. Accept instruction from his mouth and lay his words upon your heart. Like, find out why God is not happy with you. Do what he wants you to do, and this will come to an end. If you return to the Almighty, you will be restored. Again, under any other circumstance, Eliphaz would have been correct. How was he to know about the challenge presented by Satan to God to destroy a righteous man? So we see that at first Job's friends took a sympathetic, emotionally supportive role. They commiserated with Job. They tried to encourage him by laying out his record of righteousness. After all, Job had immense wealth. These must be blessings from God. But now, with everything gone, the friends changed their tone to one of rationality. They're desperate to find a solution. They can't. They're suffering with him. Seeing him like this is painful for them too, because they are real friends. They would have left long ago. I mean, I don't need to get too detailed and gross here, but you're talking about open wounds here. After days and days and days of this, it would have been uncomfortable just to be around him, let alone to see his suffering. Of course, we know from the story there was no root of sin. God had admitted to Satan that this is the most righteous man in all the earth, and he's blameless. And so God comes to Job to finally put an end to this suffering. But first, he's got to put him in his place. Because Job, no doubt, if he was guilty of anything, you would say it would be self-righteousness. Look how great I must be. I am a righteous man, and my flocks and my servants and my wealth proves it. And God is coming to him to say, wait a minute, this is nothing. This wealth that you have, I can give it, I can take it. This doesn't prove anything about you. God is basically saying in this passage, which I don't have time to read the whole, there's chapters and chapters of this. God is saying, I am sovereign. I don't need to explain myself to you. Who do you think you are? I can bring joy and happiness into your life, and I can bring or allow pain and suffering if I choose. And who are you to question me? If you've read Job, you may recall these passages about, where were you when I put the clouds in their place and the stars? Who were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Where were you? Can you count how many clouds are in the sky? He's like helping Job to put his mind into its proper, you might say, submissive place. So after this long conversation, which Job's friends could not have understood, after this time of suffering, God blesses Job with twice as much as he had before in Job 42:10. But much can be learned from the example of Job and his friends. First of all, when we are aware of a friend who is hurting, we can follow the positive example of these men by going to the person, mourning with them, and just being there and with them and for them. When I began as a ministerial trainee, I was training under a man who had many fine qualities, many. But the one thing he struggled with that I saw immediately was he could not be comfortable around sick people. So when we would go to visit people in hospital, he could not just be there with their pain. He would make jokes. He would try to make everything funny to make the person laugh so they'd feel better. He wanted them to feel better. So he cared about them deeply. But if anyone else came in the room, some other church members had come to visit, his attention would go to them and he would talk to them, and he was very uncomfortable just to be. It's very, very difficult. I don't think it's easy for anyone just to be quiet, just to sit with someone and just be there. If someone's ill in bed, I know quite often when Leona was in her hospital bed, because it wasn't a nursing home, it was a hospital basically, sometimes I would come to church and Beverly would just sit with her, and sometimes she'd want to talk. And sometimes she didn't want to talk, but she didn't say anything, but I know she would have appreciated just having someone sitting beside her, saying nothing. There's something about the fact that you give your time to me, to be with me, when you could be somewhere else. It expresses compassion in a way that words can't. Secondly, our physical presence with a hurting friend can be a great comfort in and of itself. Just the presence of someone. And maybe it's someone who you can't physically be with, but someone you check in on a daily basis and just say, hey, I was wondering how things are going today. We can join together and encourage a friend to endure faithfully, knowing God sees our pain and has a purpose for it. That's the lesson of Job, that there's a purpose for this, even if you don't see it. This is a great application of Romans 12:15, which says, rejoice with those who rejoice, but mourn with those who mourn. Don't go and tell jokes with people who are mourning to lift their spirits, to make them forget what they're dealing with, to make them happy again. Mourn with those who mourn. When we're willing to enter into the pain of a suffering friend, we follow the example of Jesus, who came to bear our pain and suffer in our place. And our help to those in need is ultimately the way we serve Christ. And when we do, we are a friend indeed.